What's up, everybody? You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM. We are a progressive politics show broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory on UBC's Point Grey campus. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
What's up?
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And for today's show, we are speaking truth to power about UBC's reconciliation poll being vandalized and the white helmets coming to UBC's campus. But before we get to all that, I would like to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the unceded territory of the Coast Salish peoples, including the territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. And rather than keeping this as a tokenistic gesture to the Indigenous peoples of Canada, as is generally done on UBC's campus, we will keep the Indigenous struggle for self-determination and justice at the forefront of our consciousness, and we will begin this show and every show until there's justice for Indigenous people talking about colonialism. So now up in colonial news, this is an article from the UBC, the campus newspaper, written by editors Alex Nguyen and Zach Vashara. The headline reads, quote, UBC's reconciliation poll vandalized before second anniversary of installation, end quote. So this is from April 1st, 2019, and this is unfortunately not an April Fool's joke. Somebody did vandalize the poll. So getting into the article here, quote, UBC's reconciliation poll was vandalized Friday, and what community members are condemning as an, quote, an affront to everyone on and off campus who embraces the poll's symbolic importance, end quote. I'm going to take a break here. Keyword, symbolic importance. Keyword, keep that in everyone's mind, symbolic importance. According to an open letter signed by First Nations House of Learning Director Dr. Margaret Moss and Senior Advisor to the President on Indigenous Affairs, Dr. Cheryl Lightfoot, three of about a dozen stakes that were surrounding the pole were removed from the ground and forcibly inserted into the pole. Two of those stakes were inserted into existing cracks in the pole, while a third was inserted into a carving. The poll showed no lasting damage. The incident was reported to campus security on March 29th by a staff member. In a statement to the UBC, University RCMP confirmed they were informed of the incident on March 29th. No suspects or witnesses have been identified and the case is ongoing. Moss and Lightfoot condemned the vandalism as being a profound act of disrespect towards victims and survivors of the Indian residential school system. Here's a quote from Moss and Lightfoot. This condemnable act profoundly disrespects everything the poll represents, from the voices and the survivors of the schools, the memories of the children who died in them, the hopes of Indigenous peoples, to the honor of all Canadians who are striving to shake free from the darkness of the past to embrace a brighter future together, reads the letter. The reconciliation poll was installed on campus in April 2017 and carved by Haida Hereditary Chief and Master Carver. I cannot pronounce that name. There is a seven in it. I am not very good at these kinds of pronunciations, who also goes by the name James Hart. Its creation was funded by UBC and the Audane Art Museum Foundation. So, about the poll, this is one of those things I always find very tough, because it's a beautiful reconciliation poll, and if anyone that's seen it on campus, it's absolutely fantastic. It's down by the forestry building. Really beautiful stuff, and I think it does signify a lot. Just at least there's some, like, recognition that, you know, maybe there was a genocide that took place, you know, that kind of some people try to, like, slip under the water, because, you know, in Germany, there's, you know, an entire Holocaust museum. They've kept the concentration camps in Poland, like Auschwitz-Birkenau. You can go visit it, and you can see the horrors of the Holocaust. And I think it's very telling as a Canadian society that, you know, we don't have those really stark images, that we don't, like, have a residential school where you can, like, tour.
Right.
And you can see, like, the mass graves they would have outside where all the kids would go. Or you could, like, go do, oh, here'd be a fun thing to do at the residential school museum, where you can go, we go through the shoe, go take a walk a mile in the shoes of the children who were forcibly, you could do, this is how you get there. You get forcibly taken away from your home by the RCMP.
Right.
You get delivered to the residential school miles away from your family, and you're beaten until you know, submit to their rules there. They make you dress differently. You have to throw away all your cultural items.
Forced to speak English.
Forced to speak English. You know, you're not allowed. Yeah, you're absolutely, there's no speaking your Indigenous language. No engaging your Indigenous culture there.
Right.
And on top of that, you then, after you try to escape because you're being raped by the priests and nuns and being abused by the RCMP there and the Catholic priests and the teachers and everybody there, you run away. So you run through the forest and then you most likely die. So that's basically, you know, how it works for the people who tried to run away. And then the people who survived, you know, are now suffering intergenerational residential school trauma.
Of course, yeah.
And what do we have to show for it as a society? Well, we have the poll,
mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, it's nice. It's better than no poll. I'm not saying that, like, you know, get rid of the poll, but it's just like...
Right. But again, it's also indicative of, like, just kind of that appropriation that we do. Like, here, we crafted an indigenous symbol. You know what
I
mean?
Yeah. And it was, like, total... And it was done by an indigenous person.
Right.
It was done by an indigenous person, so it's, like, totally cool now. It reminds me of the Vancouver 2010 Olympics, where it's, like, all indigenous art, even though there was, like, how many murdered and missing indigenous women at the time.
Right.
And Stephen Harper was doing nothing about it.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of one of those things where it's, like... I don't know. It just has never sat right with me. It's never sat right with me. And I just feel like it's one of those things that I just don't think it's being taken seriously. Because it's nice that there's the poll and, like, we talk about it, but I don't think we, like, deal with it.
Right. And I would be willing to take a poll if you, like, you know, if you polled a lot of indigenous kids, or students rather, or even, you know, adults, they're probably somewhere on the same playing field, I bet. Like, you know, yeah, it's nice, it's a nice gesture, but that's really what it is. Like, I don't really care.
I mean, it's a lot bigger than pretending like they don't exist and, like, completely genociding
them.
Yeah, we're not saying that it's not. It's just,
it's
like,
a good acknowledgement and beautiful art piece,
at the least.
And
that's the problem, though. We're setting the bar very low for reconciliation. Because,
right.
Like, in my opinion, this would be, you know, like, somewhat of, we did a Nuremberg trial for all the people that, you know, were genociding people. Like, where's our version of Nuremberg? You know, it's not like the Canadian state was found guilty of genocide.
Right. Well, let's remember Nuremberg. A lot of the guys got away.
Yeah, well, and then, of course, well, I'm not, obviously, you know, we wouldn't take the people that, you know, we wouldn't take Johnny McDonald and make him into a NASA scientist or anything like a
right.
Nuremberg. But it's just one of those things where it's, like, it's just hard to square the circle of, like, this was a genocide that happened in this, like, you know, in this very city. And in UBC, like, I don't know if you remember a few years ago, I'm going to look that guy up that they brought over. They brought over a very shady character. I'm going to try to find his name. Okay. I'm going to try to figure out who this person was. Anyways, they brought over this guy. Okay, you know what? I'm going to figure out who this person is. They brought over this guy who was at a residential school. Like, he was fully there when all that stuff was going down, and then dozens of people, like, came out and made allegations against him that he, like, abused them at the school.
Right.
And they let him keep, like, talk at this Millennium Breakfast thing that I was at years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't understand, like, how, you know, we could kind of just pretend that, you know, this school has, like, a progressive stance on, you know, indigenous people when, you know, like, look at the representation of indigenous people. There's barely any here.
Yeah.
I think, like, what, the Canadian, like, population of indigenous people is, like, 4%.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I think it's, like, 1.something% of our school population is indigenous people.
Right. I wonder
so,
why.
Yeah. It's almost like our school system excludes them on purpose or something like that.
Right. But it's probably even sadder than that.
Yeah, well, no, it is like 1%. It was brought up during the campaign period.
Right.
Also, yeah, I'd like to acknowledge that was why we were gone for 3 weeks, because I
right,
ran for
right.
school president. I unfortunately lost, but we got to talk about a lot of interesting issues, and I learned a lot of interesting things. But yeah, that was brought up because we had this talk at the Hatch Art Gallery about Indigenous issues. And my whole point was, you know, like, let's just talk about the issues that affect everybody. Like, don't get me wrong, like, there's specific Indigenous issues, but, like, pretending that Indigenous people are these, like, separate, like, I find it, like, very pedantic.
Right.
And just kind of, like, infantilizing that, like, they're this, like, special group that, like, has no...
It's a special case of victims, right? And I don't
yeah.
think they want that attached to themselves either.
Well, and it's not like they're not victimized in the same way the rest of the rest of us aren't.
Right.
Like, I mean, tuition is too expensive. If you got rid of tuition, you know, if we fought for tuition abolition, that would help Indigenous people go to university. Like,
oh, any poor people, right?
Right? And then, right? It's almost like Indigenous people are the poorest of us all, so we should probably go for that. Or, like, getting open sourcing textbooks. That would help Indigenous people, just
right.
like it would help everybody else. And
anybody,
everyone else could get
right.
behind it, because it's just like, here are some things, I don't want to use the term common sense, but, like, you know, here are some things that could, you know, actually help Indigenous people. And once again, the
right.
poll is fantastic. We love the poll. This is not an anti-poll thing. It's just one of those, this is like, it just feels like this is, like, their thing the university is using. And I just don't accept that the poll is like this like change maker, like revolutionary thing, because like a lot of people do,
right?
And I push back on that.
Well, a much better statement we can give UBC credit on is the museum, right?
Yeah, that thing's not used. I don't know if you've been there.
It seems like it.
It's not used. There, yeah. I tried going into it. You like it's super bizarre. Mm, it's just like
very plain.
Yeah. I
don't know what's up. It looks like more like an art piece itself, right?
Yeah, that seems what it is. It's pretty John Furlong. Okay, so basically this guy, there were survivor testimonies that state he abused Indigenous youth at the Immaculata Residential School near Burns Lake in BC in 1969 to 1970. How wild is that? John Furlong. They let him talk at the here's when it was. He was the keynote speaker at the University of British Columbia's upcoming 18th annual ZLC Millennium Scholarship Breakfast on February 28th, 2017.
Right. Just another privileged member of society whose misdeeds get swept under the carpet.
Yeah, it's just like totally crazy. There's an article from The Talon on this. It's pretty incredible stuff. And it just like that's the problem with this university. It's just so hypocritical, like so flagrant too. They're like really crazy about it. And this wasn't even that long. This was 2 years ago, right? So,
right.
You know, and it was Santa Ono, the same guy that does this stuff. So it's just like this very bizarre like PR like circus that they're constantly doing. And like, don't get me wrong, like it's and okay. So we've talked a lot about how lame the poll is juxtaposed with how lame the university is about Indigenous people.
Right.
Now let's talk about the actual problem, which is that people vandalize these things, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like there's actual people that are going out and vandalizing these things. And I do believe it's because we're living in a time when, you know, we're dealing with pretty reactionary politics, you know, very open, bigoted, hateful stuff. You know,
right.
We missed covering Christchurch, but that was all a big disaster. And guess who radicalized our good friends, the shooters? Who was that guy that we complained about in our first episode?
Right.
And why we didn't want him speaking on campus? Who also influenced the mosque shooter?
Right.
Ben Shapiro.
Right.
So maybe it wasn't
the right wing soft intellectual, is like they like to refer to him.
Right, soft. What are they talking about? They're just crazy. It's he's wild. He got called alt right in The Economist, and then he lost his mind because he doesn't view these alt right, even though he's like radicalized like so many like crazy like alt right white ISIS people.
Oh, when the conservatives are calling you alt right, you're probably an alt right.
I know, right? Yeah, when The Economist is not even like a left wing rag, it's The Economist. Yeah. Anyways, okay. So yeah, so that's the world we're living in. It's just this world, this era of hatred. And in my personal opinion, this is also because our economic system is falling to pieces. Right. So what we've covered before, half of Canadians are about $200 away from financial insolvency, you know, and what do people do when they have that amount of rage? And we live in a society that's we've been so indoctrinated that, you know, if you don't have stuff, you just didn't earn it.
Right.
You know, like that's the reason why you're poor, low
income.
You didn't
work hard enough.
Yeah. And so what do? Is that you take it out on people that you the media indoctrinates you into thinking aren't working harder and getting handouts from the government. You know, case in point, the reconciliation poll is vandalized. And I'm not saying it's one of those people, you know, to be completely honest with you, it could just be one of those like random, like hateful, like people. And
yeah.
It's such a bougie campus anyway.
Oh yeah. It doesn't even have to be a student necessarily, right?
Yeah, true. It could just be any hateful person.
Yeah.
There could be a lot of people out here.
Oh, definitely.
People just casually, and that's
anybody can ride the bus or drive a car. Like.
And you know, we talk a lot about the genocide and like how horrible that like massive moment in history was for Indigenous people. How about let's just talk about the daily stuff. Just like every day when people just like casually talk about Indigenous people like they're like morons or something.
Right.
Or like they have no idea what's going on around them, or that like, you know, like this whole colonization project was good for them or something like that.
Right.
Like that attitude is like an everyday attitude. And that like is totally, I don't know, just like
I'm
always
sure
present.
They're just as worried as everybody else about what it takes to survive and how they're being hindered from, you know, achieving that.
Well, and I just like, you know, like I want like I think the what happened in the past is terrible. And I think, you know, that's always good for context.
Right.
I just think that, you know, let's talk about what happens every day.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Don't get hung up too hard on the genocide in the policy sense, in that, you know, passing a law which memorializes something is very important.
Yes.
For history and for moving forward and for solidifying it, right, in a document form. But what's even more important is policy, which actually enacts change for any, you know, disenfranchised or, you know.
Yeah, like oppressed group, right. You know, like that would be good. Yet here we are where there's currently, you know, and let's talk about some current issues. Wet'suwet'en.
Right.
We covered this on the show. Coastal GasLink, unceded Wet'suwet'en territory. They try to jam the pipeline through.
Right.
The RCMP forcibly removed people on the blockade. They're dressed up like they're fighting frickin' ISIS or something. But no, it's just indigenous people.
Right, scary with their drums.
Yeah, the drum and then the
hat.
The,
oh, what are they doing?
Yeah, oh, like we're lucky they weren't the American cops or whatever. They would have choked them all to death. It's
right.
And it's, well, you know, all cops are bastards, so it doesn't really matter. All the cops suck. It's just this, like, crazy, I feel, it's the contradiction, I think, is just so heightened. So it's this one thing, where the political establishment, like Trudeau, UBC, are like this, like, kind version.
Vancouver, BC.
Yeah, Vancouver. It's everyone's like, well, we love Indigenous people.
Right.
That's, like, one side of the coin. The other side of the coin is, like, the rude, like, Albertan-style Saskatchewan, Manitoba to some extent, because, like, Manitoba's obviously a lot of Indigenous. Ontario, definitely, with Doug Ford, and Quebec, too, with some of their really retrograde attitudes, where they're like, oh, you know, like, Indigenous people don't earn things. And, like, you know, we're open for business. Like, that's kind of, like, crazy rhetoric. Like, that's what makes, you know, value in our country is, you know, selling our labor really, really cheap.
Right.
So that somebody can make a lot of profits. Like, profits are even some good way of telling if things are going well. Because it's like Adam Smith, you know, the classical economist who wrote, you know, nations with the highest profits are the fastest to ruin.
Right.
So, you know, it turns out there's a lot more to business than just profit.
No.
And if that's all you learn in business school, then you should probably, you know, but that's what they teach. So
hint,
anyway.
Hint, that's all they teach.
Yeah. Isn't that so funny? Right. Anyways.
They save the sustainability and, like, the how you help the environment. I noticed they save that for the last day.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Last day of classes. Let's talk about not dying from climate change.
I'll show you how marketing, it's all bullshit.
It is. Really? It's crazy.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's wild. But, like, and that's the thing, right? Like, you know, what did UBC do for Wet'suwet'en? Nothing. Dead silent. What is UBC doing for actual Indigenous issues? Like, I don't know, getting drinking water to, like, all the communities that don't have drinking water. It's,
right.
Like, over, like, 50.
But what's even worse is what they pretend to do and which they don't.
That's probably the most disgusting part about it, is,
yeah.
like the pretending. And the amount of people that go along with it, it's like, why?
Is the word, yeah.
You don't even, and here's the thing. It's not that you don't have to celebrate. We obviously are very happy about the poll.
Right.
Very happy about the totem pole.
Like, any step forward is good.
The reconciliation pole is great. It is awesome. It looks amazing, too. It was great work done. It's just saying that, like, is that enough? Absolutely not. Not even close. That is, like, barely, like 0.00001%
right.
of the resources, time, energy spent on, you know, decolonizing our institution. That's a word that gets thrown a lot, decolonization. What does it even mean, Spencer? Well, it just means connection to the land, you know? I like to be connected to the land, you know? I love this place, you know? I'd like to think of as my home, but oh wait, it was stolen from other people. So I would like to, you know, maybe deal with that first before I could go on with my life. And I know that most people in Canada would as well. You know who doesn't want to go along with that, Ajit? The ruling class.
Right.
And that's why we're stuck in this world. So that's why, you know, we'll be, you know, tirelessly advocating on this show that, you know, the regular people
right.
of this country need to take control. Because, you know, we're all pretty sensible people. We know we don't want to treat Indigenous people like garbage. We know that they're our friends. We know they're just like everyone else.
Right.
But to the ruling class, all they do is stand in the way of their pipelines.
Well, we got to respect the fact that the ruling class spent $2 million of their inherited money, okay? So give them a break, man.
Yeah, they spent some of the family's inherited money that they got from pushing Indigenous people around for resource
I made a $100 million business off the $50 million loan from my dad.
A small loan of $1 million. Okay, well, with my really terrible Trump joke, we will take that into the commercial break. Stick around. We will be right back.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983. Let's see what one man of prestige has to say about Discorder.
What up, though? This is Big Snoop Dogg, and I fucks with Discorder magazine. How about that?
Smoke weed every day.
Pick up a copy around Vancouver or fuck with Discorder online at discorder.ca. We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
Hello.
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu. And now we are back to talking about the White Helmets. So what are the White Helmets and why are we talking about them today? So basically, this, you know, came across my desk, aka my Facebook Messenger chat, and apparently we have this very problematic Facebook event, and we'll get to why it's problematic. We're going to have to spend the rest of the show breaking this down just because there's so much going on in this issue, but I think it is really worth discussing. I'm going to be, it's free tickets, by the way, so everyone get your tickets. We're just going to go there and, you know, try to, you know, have a, maybe disrupt a little bit in there. I'm clicking going for sure. This is a very interesting development. Okay, so the event on Facebook is called Meet the White Helmets. Hear from the heroes of the Syrian conflict. So this is at the Liu Institute for Global Issues. Mm. This is our imperialism center on campus.
Essentially.
This is where we had our very famous war criminal, Susan Rice. So who is Susan Rice? She was one of the architects of the first female-only regime change operation. So good, that was good.
Nice.
Big step for women. Yeah, that was very progressive. We have now women committing war crimes.
A progressive neocon. I love it.
Did you... Think about this, though. For all the female war criminals, they had to... How many more civilians do you think they had to kill than their male counterparts just to be treated the same?
Well, I don't know. tough question to answer. But the glass, I think they kill equitably.
You think so?
You blow up.
I would hope so.
You blow
it's
up
equal.
A neighborhood. I think the sex ratio is just determined by the, you know.
It's a this is... Now we're entering this down... Okay, so, you know, we've lived through... You know, a century of imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism.
Right.
This is where, you know, the market is not just expanded, you know, inside of countries. This is now outside of countries. That's what imperialism is, where we now, you know, divvy up the world into different spheres of influence. And, you know, the United States sphere of influence, what is it? Well, basically everywhere.
Right.
Everywhere is the U.S.'s...
They try their best.
They're doing quite well, too, about it. So that's why we're in this world. And because imperialism is so grotesque, where, you know, you have things like the Vietnam War, which made, you know, all of America, you know, like, turn off their TVs in protest because it was just so disgusting what was happening to innocent rice paddy farmers.
Right.
Now we have to counteract that rather than doing... What would you do if you... Okay, so you watch the Vietnam War on your TV screen and you see, you know, all your friends and family getting drafted. You knew somebody who died there over, you know, God knows what battle, who you're fighting in,
right,
you know, Vietnam over what. How would you solve that problem?
God, I...
You could do anything you want. You're not in the... You're you could just...
Not limited by democracy.
No, you're not limited. You can do anything you want. What would you do after, you know, you've seen the horrors of war?
I mean, like, if I had any influence in government...
You have all the influence. You're a supreme dictator.
Okay, well, you stop the war. You stop killing poor
people.
Wow.
Wow. How dare you, Ajit? How dare you stop killing people?
Right.
Do what we need. We need more females at the helm of killing people. That is the problem. There wasn't a female representation.
I think there is a ready and able pool waiting.
Yeah, no, that is...
Coming out of yours truly, universities like this all over the world.
Yeah, mostly Harvard, Yale. That's where they usually get these, like, sickos. But yeah, that's where they get these war criminal killers people from. So we have our own version. It's called the Liu Institute for Global Affairs, aka Imperialism. And so let me read the description. So don't miss this special event at UBC with the White Helmets delegation to Canada as they discuss their rescue operations in Syria and more. All are welcome. The event is co-hosted by the Department of Sociology, the School of Public Policy and Global Affairs, and Development and Alumni Engagement, Faculty of Arts. So this is super problematic. Sorry, here's some more. The White Helmets, a.k.a. the Syrian Civil Defense, saved more than 100,000 civilians during the Syrian Civil War. Several members are visiting Canada to speak about their work. They'll be joined by a fourth speaker who is a Syrian refugee now living in Vancouver.
Man, shame on you, Arts. We're supposed to be the faculty which is the most informed on world affairs. And journalism is a major in here, so dig below the truth. So you study in any arts majors, dig beneath the bullshit.
I will be contacting all the journalists on campus and asking about this, because this is one of those stories that I think will just be totally left under the radar until somebody reports on it.
Who do you think's organizing this? Probably some Syrian international kid whose dad runs a business.
We're going to get to actually who runs the White Helmets in this really amazing piece by Max Blumenthal for Alternet. This was October 2nd, 2016, and this is pretty mind-blowing stuff. So this article's headlined, "How the White Helmets Became International Heroes While Pushing U.S. Military Intervention and Regime Change in Syria." Created by Western governments and popularized by a top PR firm, the White Helmets are saving civilians while lobbying for airstrikes. I just want to read this in its entirety because it's just so crazy.
Right.
It's just so good. And it just, this is like what level of insanity we're at UBC. Yeah. "It is rare for a short Netflix documentary to garner as much publicity or acclaim as The White Helmets has. Promoted as the, just to interrupt. Ajit, have you seen The White Helmets on Netflix?
I have not, but I definitely...
You remember it, eh?
Yeah, we talked about this, and I remember.
Okay, dope. "Promoted as a story of real-life heroes and impossible hope, the film is named for the Civil Defense Organization whose members have gained international acclaim for saving lives in rebel-held territory in the hellish war zones of eastern Aleppo and Idlib. The film's tagline, 'To save one life is to save all of humanity,' that is remarkably similar to that of Steven Spielberg's Holocaust epic, Schindler's List. Whoever saves one life saves the world entire." The Netflix feature comes on the heels of a Nobel Peace Prize nomination for The White Helmets, an alternative Nobel Award known as the Right Livelihood Award, and endorsements from an assortment of celebrities. The move by the celebrities draws attention to both the horror of the conflict and the growing willingness of well-known Americans to adopt its cause, wrote Liam Stack of The New York Times. Footage of the White Helmets saving civilians trapped in the rubble of buildings bombed by the Syrian government and its Russian ally has become ubiquitous in the coverage of the crisis. An international symbol of courage under fire, the group has become a leading resource for journalists and human rights groups seeking information inside the war theater, from casualty figures to details on the kind of bombs that are falling. The bravado displayed by the White Helmets under Syrian government and Russian bombardment has captivated some of the most influential observers of the Syrian conflict. The White Helmets are touted for... Oh, here's a great one. Laura Rosenberg, a foreign policy advisor to Hillary Clinton, also took to Twitter to promote the group, posting a Wall Street Journal article hailing the civil defense group as, quote, white knights for desperate Syrians, end quote. Hillary Clinton quickly retweeted Rosenberger, registering her own tacit endorsement for the White Helmets. On September 22nd, Secretary of State John Kerry declared that he was, quote, honored to meet the White Helmets leader and Aleppo activists, end quote, hailing the organization as, quote, brave first responders on the scene, end quote. The White Helmets are touted for saving tens of thousands alive. And just to take a break, Ajit, do you remember how much the UBC description claimed that they saved?
Oh, I bet the
they said 100,000.
Really? Okay. So they're even inflating the number.
Yeah, well, let's get to it. The White Helmets are touted for saving tens of thousands of lives, though estimates on exactly how many varies dramatically depending on the source. The recently released White Helmets Netflix documentary claims they've saved over 55,000 people, while Georgetown Security Studies Review had that number at 15,500 in May 2015. The State Department claimed that this April, so this is April 2016, that 40,000 had been rescued by White Helmets, but AJ Plus, a subsidiary of Al Jazeera, asserted at the same time that more than 24,000 have been saved. In a separate report published 4 months later, AJ quoted the figure at 60,000, which is the figure the White Helmets themselves claim. Whatever the number, there's little dispute that the White Helmets rank and file are saving lives in what seems to be an increasingly desperate situation in eastern Aleppo. So this is how propaganda works, people. It's not about, you know, facts or the truth. It is about... it is purely about repetition.
Right?
It's all about just like getting that into your head. White Helmets save people. White Helmets save people.
Getting you to believe the lie.
And you just don't never question it.
No.
I never questioned it. I was just like, oh, interesting.
Awesome.
Cool documentary.
Some positivity in my shitty day.
Yeah, right? And Netflix wouldn't lie to me. Oh, wait. Guess who's in charge of it?
The CIA?
No, guess who's on their board of directors?
national
Susan thing. Rice.
Oh wow!
Can you?
what's a government like agent? What's her experience in business? A diplomat.
Oh, she's good at regime change propaganda, so right. It's good that, you know, wait until they start putting out the Venezuela documentaries and the Putin diaries.
Right, but don't worry, you get your safe dosage of liberal documentaries as well, because just to show you, we're on your side still.
So. Fascism is killing 51 people in mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand.
Right.
Liberalism is killing 51 Muslims with a drone bomb.
Mm.
Anyways, back to the article. Yet the group is anything but impartial. The White Helmets' leadership is driven by a pro-interventionist agenda conceived by the Western governments and public relations group that back them. Anyone who visits the group's website, which is operated by an opposition-funded PR company known as the Syria Campaign, will be immediately directed to a request to sign the petition for a no-fly zone to stop the bombs in Syria. These sorts of communiques highlight the dual role the White Helmets play as a civil defense organization saving lives while lobbying for a U.S. military campaign that will almost inevitably result in the collapse of Syria's government.
They're still trying.
They're still going. They're still going. They're spreading that. Well, it's because
we're 8 years strong. So
I. You know what? Honestly, here's my thoughts so far. And this is just like right off the cuff because like this came across my desk relatively recently.
Right.
I think that. They like the deep state military industrial complex, State Department, CIA, Pentagon people are all thinking that, you know, Trump loses in 2020. We're going to revamp the war in Syria.
Mm.
And we're going to give because, you
to
know,
help our man.
Well, because, well, I mean, Syria is almost like eradicated ISIS. So it's like it's over.
Right.
But I think they're going to ratchet up tensions again. Just like, you know, in Iraq, they did Gulf War One.
Right.
They did a Gulf War too.
Right, right. Now it's going to be in between the different insurgent groups, not just ISIS.
Well, they tried getting ISIS to do it for them.
Right.
And, you know, Russia and Syria wiped them off the face of the
earth. It's going from a triple-way civil war to just, to, you know. Well, it's already probably a multi-party civil war, so who knows?
Yeah, who knows what's going on here? It's pretty crazy what these people get away with. Yeah, the Syrian war in and of itself is quite the debacle. And a lot of people don't even understand that it's ISIS who America is funding. They call them the moderate rebels.
Right.
They're funding the moderate rebels, ISIS, and al-Nusra.
Right.
These like horrible terrorist groups because they're fighting the Syrian government.
Same type of guys who would do 9/11.
Like the very same.
Yeah.
And ironically enough, they're fighting ISIS in Iraq and they're arming ISIS in Syria.
Well,
this is the stuff that makes your head spin. Anyways,
it's
okay.
Just state building, okay?
Yeah, state. According to a 2012 Pentagon estimate, a no-fly zone would require at least 70,000. So, you know, the White Helmets are calling for this. The White Helmets are calling for a no-fly zone. A no-fly zone would require at least 70,000 American servicemen. According to the Pentagon, to enforce along with the widespread destruction of Syrian government infrastructure and military installations. Right. Also sometimes called safe zones or buffer zones. How Orwellian is that language?
Hmm. Yeah,
safe zones or buffer zones or no-fly zones to save people, but it's going to mean regime change and 70,000 troops on the ground.
Right.
That's crazy. From Yugoslavia to Iraq to Libya, no-fly zones have served almost without exception as the preamble to regime change. With no clear plan in place for the day after the government falls or any conclusive evidence that its ouster is what most Syrians want, the Western government's professional activists and public relations specialists who created the White Helmets are intensifying their push for regime change, and they've brought it here to UBC, courtesy of the Sociology Department.
Mm.
The White Helmets were founded in collaboration with USAID's Office of Transitional Initiatives. How horrible of a name is that? Transitional Initiatives.
This is a code word.
That is Orwellian. This is so crazy. We really do live in 1984 world.
Mm.
The wing that has promoted regime change around the world and has been provided with $23 million in funding from the department. USAID supplies the White Helmets through Chemonix, a for-profit contractor, so the military-industrial complex, for-profit contractor based in Washington, D.C., that has become notorious for wasteful aid imbroglios from Haiti to Afghanistan, to places where a lot of humanitarian work is being done, clearly. While members of the White Helmets have been implicated in atrocities carried out by jihadist rebels, groups, the names of many of the firms that supposedly monitor and evaluate their work have been kept secret by USAID on unspecified security grounds.
Well then, bought and paid for.
jihadists bought and paid for. Yeah, it's just, it's kind of hard to wrap your head around.
This is the way we do imperialism always, though, right? Like, the veil of benevolence.
Yeah.
They're saving people, but, you know, the truth is somewhere underneath.
Yeah.
But we've uncovered it.
And they're, and just like in Central America, when they're giving, like, in the dirty wars, they are giving arms to these crazy, you know, Contras and right-wing death squads. That's kind of what they're doing in Syria, except with, you know, well, with right-wing, like, ISIS, jihadists.
Right, just so, just show some footage of kids going to a school and or women voting, right? That's what they love.
It's, yeah, it, and it makes everyone feel good because, you know, think about half of every American dollar goes to the military. So you better be doing something, which is almost, it's almost like deterministic. If you spend that much money on the military, you're going to use it, right?
Oh, well, they don't, but yeah.
Yeah, they do use it to fund their military contractor friends.
Right.
And they have to put the bombs somewhere to make more bombs.
And get some votes from Ohio or whatever.
Yeah, wherever. Or Seattle for the Boeing factory.
Right there.
Yeah, and all the other munitions places. It's an entire economy based on war.
Essentially.
I wonder what could go wrong. Maybe climate change. Hey-oh. Okay. Away from the battlefield, the White Helmets have proven one of the most effective tools in the Syria campaign's public relations arsenal. Apart from the group's own calls for a no-fly zone, the White Helmets have been at the center of the Syria campaign's ongoing attack on the United Nations, which it accuses of illicit collusion with Assad. This month, the White Helmets, Syria's President Assad. This month, the White Helmets joined 74 other groups operating in rebel-held territory, announced their refusal this month to cooperate with the UN as long as it recognizes the Syrian government. In a separate move, the Syria campaign launched a petition to demand that the United States National Security Council share confidential radar information with White Helmets teams operating on the ground, apparently including in areas controlled by extremist rebel factions.
Well, then.
It's just so crazy.
I mean, it's pretty obvious.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And, like, what I want to know is just, like, where do they find these people?
Well,
is there no one else to bring in to talk?
Yeah, I mean.
Oh, how about Chelsea Manning to talk about whistleblowing? Oh, wait, she's in jail.
No. No.
How about Edward Snowden to talk about whistleblowing?
Oh, well, wait, how hard is it to pay some stooge, right, to talk?
I figured they were going to pick the regime change stooges.
Hmm.
Yeah, maybe this is what they do. Every other year, they bring in just this horrible, like, you know, war criminal onto campus and get people, like, used to it.
Right.
This is so crazy.
Subtlety.
I'm very excited for this event, to say the least. We'll finish up a few more points before we get to commercial. In May 2015, the White Helmet spokesperson Raed Saleh met privately with UN and EU officials to push for a no-fly zone. A month later, Saleh's colleague Farouk Habib testified before the U.S. House Committees on Foreign Affairs in a support of a no-fly zone, claiming to possess firsthand knowledge of chemical weapons attacks by the Syrian government. The new WMDs, with the Obama administration having drawn its red line at the deployment of chemical weapons, allegations like these are potential trigger points for full-scale U.S. military intervention. So remember Ajit, so this was a year ago, mm-hmm. in 2018, when they, remember the fake chemical weapons attacks?
Yeah, in Syria.
Yes.
Well, they've been touting that horn for a while now.
Yeah, how crazy. I just can't.
That's their favorite precursor or justification for regime change in the Middle East, chemical weapons.
And WMDs.
Right.
Even though the chemical weapons that Saddam had were given to him by the United States to use against Iran.
Right. Anthrax, brought to you from Georgia.
Shout out Georgia. Yeah, it's something. We're going to take a short break for commercial, and then we'll be right back to talk about more White Helmets. Stay tuned.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
We are so happy because Fun Drive 2019 is officially over. What a great feeling. To everyone who donated their time, their energy, and their money, the people who forgot to donate now but will online at citr.ca/donate, those who couldn't donate this year but will next year, and to our community as a whole. CITR and Discorder just want to say...
What's up, everybody? We're back. You're listening to the Spencer Latu Show on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from Unseo Musqueam territory. I'm with my co-host, Ajit.
What's up?
And I'm your host, Spencer Latu, and we're here talking about the White Helmets, because the White Helmets are coming to campus, and nobody looks into these things, and nobody thinks that anyone, that people are just too stupid at this institution to notice that, yeah, these people are part of the regime change issue in Syria. So why did the Syrian war get so crazy? Well, the United States wanted to overthrow Assad. Why do they want to overthrow Assad? Because Assad, the president of Syria, was going to build a pipeline through, and here we go again, all the world's problems revolve around pipelines, to sell Russia oil. And that's what it's all about with these people.
You know what one of the conservative slogans is for the upcoming campaign? Pipelines for prosperity.
Interesting. Let's define prosperity.
Right.
Yeah, like prosperity for what? Like the oil executives from Texas, which is where Kinder Morgan's located anyway.
Or yeah. Malaysia, Petronas, you know.
Yeah, all those really Canadian crude. That's exactly what we need going on.
Right. But a refugee took your job, so.
Yeah, and it's all refugees' fault for whatever. It's not the surplus value exploited by these massive corporations. So let's go back to the article on Alternet. This is written by Max Blumenthal on October 2nd, 2016. The headline is How the White Helmets Became International Heroes While Pushing U.S. Military Intervention and Regime Change in Syria. So this is the subheading, The White Helmets in Washington. September 27th, 2016, the White Helmets members dug survivors and bodies from the ruins of buildings in the rebel-held war zone of eastern Aleppo. Two of the group's public representatives appeared in Washington for a series of events and high-level meetings. The first event, open to the public, was held at the Atlantic Council. Ajit, do you remember the Atlantic Council?
Oh, of course.
The Atlantic Council, which is also tasked with who's in charge of looking at censorship and finding fake news on Facebook? The Atlantic Council. So,
wow.
I mean, now we're seeing a lot of crossover into some scary regime change stuff. So I guess they're going to weaponize Facebook for regime change as well. I wonder if they're going to delete my comments that I'm going to post about the White Helmets.
Oh, I think they'll just be buried in the ones the bots produce.
Yeah, all the Russian bots that influenced all of no election. Boom Roast said, we're right about Russiagate. Okay, here's my 5 seconds of gloating up top. Ajit, right. High five. Okay, that was a sad high five, and you couldn't hear it. Yeah, high five. One, two, three. That was us clapping our hands to pretend it was high-fiving. Bad
no.
Radio. Yes. Okay, so the first event open to the public was held at the Atlantic Council, an influential think tank with close ties to the Obama administration, and took place under the banner of the Rafik Hariri Center for the Middle East, which is named for and funded by the family of the assassinated former Lebanese prime minister who amassed his fortune through business ties to the Saudi royal family. Rafik's son, Saad, blames the Syrian government for killing his father and creating ISIS and has effectively called for its removal. Presiding over the White Helmets reception was Frederick Hoff, the director of the Hariri Center, a former advisor to Hillary Clinton on Syrian, quote, transition, and a longtime State Department envoy in the Middle East. Hoff has said his focus on Syria at the State Department was motivated by the prospect of, quote, beating Hezbollah and its Iranian master, end quote,
God.
A goal he found inspiring. As he introduced the White Helmets, Hoff accused Syrian President Bashar al-Assad of committing war crimes with impunity and demanded that his government pay a heavy price. While conceding that a no-fly zone was not a feasible option because it would subject the U.S. Air Force to Syria's anti-aircraft systems, Hoff told me he preferred cruise missile strikes against Syrian military installations and arming the moderate rebels,
yeah,
ISIS, with man-pad shoulder-mounted anti-aircraft missiles.
Hey, you got to give the man props for knowing exactly what he wants.
Yeah, he's been thinking about this for a long time. He's probably salivating thinking about war, death, and destruction.
Oh, absolutely.
These are the sickest people, and for whatever reason, they're also like so celebrated. It really disgusts you.
Well, you know, same sort of privileged douches celebrate them.
Yeah, yeah. The same people that fetishize violence. And, of course, like, where are you in the war? Of course, nowhere near.
Yeah, chicken hawks.
Yeah, chicken hawk big time.
Yeah.
When Max Blumenthal asked if he, Frederick Hoff feared such sophisticated weapons, so, these shoulder-mounted anti-aircraft missiles. The journalist Max Blumenthal asked Frederick Hoff if he feared such sophisticated weapons falling into the hands of Jabhat Fateh al-Sham or Ahrar al-Sham, the jihadist groups that boast the most manpower and battlefield prowess. Hoff accused me of ignorance about the Defense Department's foolproof vetting mechanisms. The Defense Department has also... It cannot account for $20 trillion worth of money. So I would not be surprised if a few terrorists got a few anti-aircraft missiles.
Hmm.
Yeah, because I don't think they really care. I think that the Defense Department is more concerned about getting the weapons out and buying more of them.
Right.
Than they are making sure that they end up in the right hands.
You got to get rid of the inventory, right? It's like a business.
It is a business. I'm glad. There you go. Thank you, Ajit. You really blew up. War is a business.
Absolutely.
War is
the best kind because you can just create it out of nothing.
You need the sinking of the Lusitania. Mm-hmm. You need the sinking of you need the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Right.
Pearl Harbor. You need that. You need 9/11. You need WMDs in Iraq. Mm. You know, you need a lot of things to set off a war.
Russia.
Yeah, Russia. Oh. Russian bots. You know, people compare that to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you can see they're really trying. Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, goodness. Okay, back to the article. After a screening of the trailer for The White Helmets, Hoff introduced the Civil Defense Group as the Civil Defense Group, which is The White Helmets, as a heroic and absolutely impartial party to the conflict, even though we discussed earlier in the article how the White Helmets are lobbying for a no-fly zone on their website, so they're very partial for the no-fly zone.
Right.
He then welcomed Saleh, the White Helmet spokesman, to the stage. Our demand is not for support to continue the work of the White Helmets. Rather, our demand is to stop the killing itself so that we don't have to continue this awful job, Saleh said. Seated beside Saleh and providing live translation was Kenan Rahmani, a legal and strategy advisor to the Syria campaign. The Syria campaign is a private company founded by a New York and London-based public relations firm called Purpose in order to generate public pressure for the removal of Syria's government. It led the push for the White Helmets' Nobel Prize nomination, orchestrated the group's endorsement from Hollywood celebrities, and has fundraised for its Netflix documentary vehicle. Rahmani, for his part, was a policy advisor to the Coalition for a Democratic Syria, an umbrella organization of exile groups with close ties to the Syrian rebels and neoconservative organizations in Washington before he took his current job at the Syria campaign. When I asked Saleh about how the White Helmets' demand for a no-fly zone fit with its claim to uphold impartiality, Rahmani interjected to defend his company's work. Of course we are an impartial, non-political organization, he said. The Syria campaign doesn't take political sides, but our position is a no-fly zone. A no-fly zone would stop the suffering, would stop the destruction. Saleh of the White Helmets followed up with his own call for a no-fly zone, telling me that if I understood the scale of destruction in Syria, I would agree with his demand. It sounds like saying that if you're asking for a no-fly zone, is that not a political position?
Yeah, absolutely.
Come on.
Well, the way they've kind of sold the whole no-fly zone is that it's a humanitarian action, which is, of course, bullshit. Because your jets are still in the sky, right?
Isn't that these bombs are for peace and democracy. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, the 70,000 troops that will come down to create the no-fly zone are there for peace.
Well, again, just to the whole point about how hard they're reaching, just they want this war so bad. You know, American public isn't going to go through with this.
Ajit, you and I are the smartest people on earth, right?
I think so.
Actually, no, we're pretty average students. I'm not gonna lie. I'm graduating soon, so I don't feel too bad saying this. I'm a below average student, and I can see right through this.
Right.
So that only means that all the people at the Lew Institute, all the people at the sociology department, all the people that are PhDs. Clearly can see through it, yet
right.
Here we are.
In your ivory tower.
Yeah, in your ivory tower of like, oh, regime change, good. It's like, I don't know about that.
No.
Back to the article. Moments after the panel discussion ended, Romani approached Max Blumenthal to complain about Max Blumenthal's line of questioning. "These people, the White Helmets, are saving lives," he began. But before he could complete a sentence, Romani was whisked away by Anna Nolan, the Purpose Firm's director of strategy who oversaw the Syria campaign's foundation. From that point on, Romani refused to speak to me. Me being Max Blumenthal. Seated in the front row throughout the event was Ayman Asfari, one of the main funders of the Syria campaign and a top exile supporter of the Syrian opposition. The billionaire CEO of the petroleum services company Petrofac, Asfari contributed $180,000 of the Syria campaign's $800,000 budget this year. Most of the company's donors are anonymous. I approached Asfari on his way out to ask how long he planned to continue directing his fortune towards promoting regime change. Quote, "There is a political process which is a transition. We just want to bring back the transition," end quote, he said before disappearing into an elevator. In a few hours, Asfari would host a screening of The White Helmets at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Ironic for the International Peace place to be talking about war.
Well,
so.
Up is down. So
up is down, down is up. America is good. Brown people are bad. That's all you need to know if you are on CNN. Yeah, MSDNC pushed this. CNN pushed this. Fox pushed this. Everybody was pushing this.
MSDNC, nice.
And even, you know, ironically enough, when Trump was like, "Why are we in Syria?" Why? That was like...
It's the truth.
Yeah, and it was. It shook things up. It shook things up.
Right.
Okay, now let's get into the... let's get into the Syria campaign hones the message. In 2014, the year after USAID dispersed its seed money for the White Helmets, an outfit called the Syria campaign suddenly materialized to mobilize even greater support for Western intervention through online clicktivism. Among the group's primary functions has been marketing the White Helmets to Western media consumers as non-political heroes saving lives in a sea of sectarian villains. We went to meet the White Helmets at a training in southern Turkey. They were focused on the training, and we were like, "We'd like to elevate you guys and get the inspiring work you do out to the world," James Sadri, campaign director at the Syria campaign, told Max Blumenthal. Back in November 2014, Tom Dixon, the managing director of Purpose Europe, a former advisor to Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd, and an original Syria campaign board member, issued a report detailing how his firm's White Helmet campaign uses compelling storytelling to mobilize public support. Dixon wrote, "Purpose believed their story had the power to inspire empathy and action to the wider public and launched the White Helmets campaign in August as a part of an ongoing effort to build support for the protection of civilians. Crediting the Syria's campaign promotion of the White Helmets with significant breakthroughs on public engagement, media narratives, and funding, Dixon boasted of elite meetings in New York and D.C., as well as coverage in outlets from BBC to the New York Times. Among the most effective storytelling vehicles, according to Dixon, was the Miracle Baby video portraying the dramatic rescue of baby Mahmoud from beneath the rubble of a bombed-out house by a White Helmets team. The episode featured prominently in the documentary White Helmets, and even in a cameo appearance by Mahmoud himself, now a toddler. The Netflix film appears to be at least partly the handiwork of the Syria campaign. This July, staffers of the PR company appeared in the studios of Channel 4 in London at a gathering of wealthy donors known as the Funding Network. The Syria campaign made a fantastic pitch for funding their outreach work surrounding the White Helmets, the Funding Network reported. The group noted, however, that for reasons of confidentiality, we were unable to post the Syria campaign's pitch for the time being.
Wow.
On September 30th, the attacks of the on the rebel-held areas at September 30th, 2016, the attacks on the rebel-held areas of Aleppo reached a level of unprecedented ferocity. The Syria campaign sent out an email and social media blast in the name of heroes of Syria like the White Helmets. The message urged supporters into the streets for a weekend of action to clamor for a no-fly zone, or what the PR euphemistically describes as an all aircraft dropping bombs on civilians grounded. "In solidarity, please cover your face in dust and share it with your friends on social," the Syria campaign advised. "If you can do this with a friend or family member, even better." That is very dystopian.
Right.
That is very dystopian.
It's like, you know, they're cool with killing their own people in a way. And in fact, they're encouraging it. Because they're just, you know, trying to use this imperialist framework, which just exists, to kind of... wipe out the people who are going to oppose them, you know, once the situation with ISIS is dealt with.
Yeah, they're, like, totally fine with just having a horrible, because that's what this is. And I wish that, you know, it could be called out for what it is. And I'm just kind of like saddened, at least, that you can't ever call it this. Because, like, what is war? Killing people.
Right.
And they're just flat out calling for the deaths of, like, so many people
mm-hmm.
from having a no-fly zone and just full-on toppling the Syrian government. Did they even ask the people of the Syria if right. it was okay to get rid of the government? Like, who even said this was okay?
Right. Well, first they were with it because, you know, it was in the name of progressivism, the whole Arab Spring, you know.
Which was, like, a whole CIA, like, funded op.
Right.
Which is, and led to this disgusting show of... imperialists going along to get along, and it comes home to roost where
mm-hmm.
our lovely school,
right?
And you know, and to tie it into the vandalism of the poll, you know, you when you have hatred, death, and destruction abroad, it comes home to roost.
Oh, absolutely.
If you build an economy on the destruction of other people and places. And the ceiling of things, it just seems like the logical conclusion to, like, the colonization that's happening here.
Right. Well, what does it tell you? They'll kill anyone, right? They'll kill you, too. American citizens, Canadian, forget about
well,
it.
Well, who are they sending out to war? Right. Who's going to go fight in this war?
Right. And who are they selling, you know, opiates to?
Yeah. So. And who are they making the money off of, right? It's right. us. And right. it's just and it's just this horrible economic, terrible system that... has no place for human beings in it.
No.
Because human beings are just fodder.
Right. Or, you know, sources just to squeeze the juice out of them, right?
Yeah, just, and for what? To make a buck?
Right. For a guy who already has a lot of bucks.
Yeah, right. It's not even for the betterment. Because that's the thing, too. It's like the whole argument is like, oh, it's for the good of everyone. Like, is it?
No, it's good for their fourth investment home.
The richest person on earth, one of the many companies they own, it's good for them. It's terrible for everyone else. And now we get to hear them talk at UBC.
Yeah, to brainwash us.
Yeah, we have the regime change arm of the Syrian war coming to UBC, knowing that they spent our tuition money booking these sickos that are calling for a no-fly zone, which would mean a full-on war with Syria, and that was totally okay with everybody. So,
right, and I'm sure you'll meet some pretty cool people who've rescued, you know, one or two people, or whoever, however many. The point is... what do they stand for?
Exactly. It's like, oh my God, this cop saved my life this one time. And it's like, well, it also ended like five others. And they also right. uphold this horrible system of like private property, which is just exploitative of workers. Like, you know, it's, we're not saying like, oh my God, like, oh, how dare you be mad at the people that save lives? I'm like, I'm not saying they like didn't save lives. What I'm saying is that, you know, and like Ajit so aptly put, it's what they stand for, and what they stand for is regime change, which is war,
mm-hmm.
which is innocent people losing their lives for over what?
Over nothing, over a shifting of power.
Yeah, like, and this is, you know, hopefully we can start to get into this and we can start spreading this consciousness, but there can be no peace under capitalism.
Right.
As long as there's a buck to be made, there's always a need for more war. War is a racket. Smedley Butler wrote that. Major General, 2-time Medal of Honor winning.
Right.
Smedley Butler wrote that because that's what this is.
Over 80 years ago.
Yeah, and it's never rung truer today.
Oh.
And to all the people that just welcome this stuff really uncritically, which is basically everyone at the school.
Oh, yeah.
It's just really a shame because this is supposed to be a place of like critical thinking.
But really,
the lack of it is shocking.
Right.
Absolutely shocking how little thinking is happening right now. So,
God.
Oh, goodness. I'm thrilled to be a part of this, to say the least. I am very excited to see what's about to occur. Unfortunately, this is the end of our show tonight. We're very happy to be back. We'll be back next week to talk more politics. You can find us on Apple Podcasts. If you want to hear more of our show, we'll be talking more politics next week. Thank you so much for listening.
Hello, my name is Matt, and this is a show called Stranded, the Australian Canadian Music Show. There was a special guest host last week for Stranded. CITR Radio hosts a fun drive every year. You can still donate, actually, by going to this website, http://fundrive.nationbuilder.com, or you can find it through the CITR.ca website.